Welcome to the Oh Wow Science Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by the UIF Adult Education Program at the Unalaska Learning Center. At UIF, we honor and recognize that we are on Indigenous Onangam Tanangin land where this podcast is being recorded. My name is Tatiana, and my goal is to bring you fun science facts and ideas every Friday at noon and Saturday at 4 p.m. on KUCB. Welcome to Episode 6, Birds and Ornithology. Quote, "Birds represent a link to both our natural environment and to the possibility of freedom to soar without boundaries." Quote by Rumap. Birds. So, birds are probably one of the first things in nature that people and kids notice when they're growing up. And that's because birds are these really beautifully accessible creatures that remind you that you live in the natural world. After you've been in the office or staring at screens all day, for example. And they're really easy to see. They come to your bird feeder, you see them migrating, or you hear them calling from the sky. Or, in our case, like with the bald eagles and ravens that we have, they are pretty in your face here in Unalaska. You have to be very careful around them during the breeding season in the spring. But overall, it's one of the first entrances into nature that kids get. And birds are also beautiful and easily distinguishable one from the other. For example, you probably know the difference between an eagle and a small songbird. And you can see both of them in one day, or even together. So birds have captivated human imagination for the history of humanity. We've identified with birds as a symbol of nature. We've invented cultural stories about birds. We have made creation stories, and birds are even in the Bible. Basically, birds are everywhere. The creation stories that I'm familiar with have a lot of ravens in them, actually. Ravens have become the symbol of premonition or something, at least in my culture, which is Russian culture. But I think ravens are also found in many other creation and folk stories. This may be because ravens are super intelligent and can recognize individual humans. They even follow people around. So maybe that's why people have taken to them in folk stories. And another thing about birds is that they're found everywhere in the world. They're not like elephants or polar bears or alligators that are usually very limited to a continent or a specific climate. Birds are everywhere. Maybe they're a little bit like human beings in the sense that they've conquered every continent and every climate on Earth. But in my opinion, they're better at it than humans are, mostly because they can fly and have some amazing migrating abilities. Also, did you know that birds are dinosaurs? They are real life current dinosaurs. And some people have these dinosaurs as pets. So yes, they are directly related to dinosaurs, which means they aren't mammals like us or fish. And they're kind of related to reptiles, and by that I mean the lizards, turtles, snakes, and alligators. But birds are not fully reptiles because they have warm blood like us mammals, and they don't require the sun or the environment to warm them up. This is different from reptiles, which are called ectotherms, meaning cold-blooded. Reptiles rely on the sunshine or hot climates to be able to have energy or move around. And this is why we at all don't have snakes in Alaska. And a lot of people are happy about that. And it's just way too cold for snakes. They can't regulate their blood temperature. So they just freeze. They're cold-blooded. Because that means their inside temperature has to match the outside temperature. So yeah, birds are dinosaurs, and they're the only dinosaurs to survive the extinction of dinosaurs, which happened due to an asteroid that hit the Earth around 66 million years ago. There's so much I can say about this topic because I'm a bird biologist, and I've done both research and field work with birds. But in this episode, I want to briefly talk about why scientists study birds and a little bit about what it's like to be a field biologist studying birds in the wilderness. So why study birds? And by the way, ornithology is the term we use to call the study of birds. What do you think of when you think of ornithologists or bird biologists? What do you think it means to study birds? And why on earth would it be interesting to study birds besides looking at them or bird watching? And for the record, bird watching is not the same as ornithology. While ornithologists do lots of bird watching, ornithology is very specific and targeted to a research question. As opposed to bird watching or birding, on the other hand, is considered mostly a hobby in order to see the diverse species of an area or to make a life list of all the bird species you've seen in your life. Especially because bird species vary a lot by the area you're in, and some species are only found in one state, for example. As opposed to other species that are found everywhere in North America. And while others are only found out in the ocean and mostly don't come to land. So you have to get on a boat to see them. That's why it's kind of a big deal to have a life list of birds for some birders. But the study of birds or ornithology goes a step further and wants to understand all the different ways that birds are important species in the animal kingdom for science. So here's where I'm going to talk about some ways that scientists focus on studying birds. One of the ways is looking at birds in the ecosystem and how they're connected to everything else in the environment. Because birds are really good indicators of ecosystem health. For example, birds are dependent on trees or insects, and a healthy bird population means there's plenty of food, like insects, and plenty of nesting habitat, like trees. Although, side note, not all birds use trees to make nests. Some nest right on the ground. Another way to study birds is to look at their unique behaviors that we barely understand, like migration. So far, we know that birds can use both the stars and the magnetic field of the Earth to migrate, but we still don't really know how birds do this. It's amazing, actually, because if you take a bird and move it to the other side of the world, it will get up and fly right back home to where it came from. How does it know where to go if it doesn't know where it is? So say you take a bird from Alaska and you go to Australia with it on a plane or something. That bird can immediately find its way back home, although this isn't true for exactly every bird species. Some birds can still get lost, but migration is even more interesting because and by the way, migration is what birds do to go from their winter ground to their summer ground in order to search for food or breeding. But migration is interesting because birds somehow know how to do it every year. Where to go, when to go, and how to come back. And not all birds migrate. Lots of birds in tropical climates actually don't migrate because they have lots of food year-round where they are. But birds that live in climates with winters or cold climates like Alaska have to migrate in order not to starve in the winter. Depending on what they eat, of course, but usually birds will follow their food sources like many animals and even some humans do. A fascinating example of migration is accomplished by the Arctic tern, which has the longest migration of any animal and migrates from the North Pole to the South Pole for half the year and then right back, so literally crossing the entire globe, which is a round trip of over 18,000 miles. Can you imagine crossing the globe twice a year? I guess maybe some people do it on planes, but in this case, the birds are following the food sources. That's why they do it. And I mentioned that many birds leave for the winter, but actually, it depends on the kind of bird. So lots of songbirds in the northern hemisphere who feed on insects have to fly south to Central America or South America for the winter, where it's summertime. Summertime there is wintertime here. But here in Alaska, we actually get most of our duck species migrating to us for the winter. So you will see lots of duck species and lots of variety of birds in the winter during the harshest months, you know, those times when you don't want to go outside. And then when summer comes and you're finally able to go outside and enjoy it, all these birds are gone because their food has moved. So that was a really surprising thing for me when I moved here because I mostly had experience with forest birds. And I never knew that wintertime could be such a bird paradise in the Alaskan tundra. It's also pretty hard to go birding in the winter here with the storms and the darkness. So I kind of wish the ducks were here in the summer instead, but I can't tell them what to do, I guess. Studying bird migration also ties in with the study of bird flight. Bird flight is super complex and it's very interesting because, first of all, I've always watched birds soar and cover miles of ground in the sky, and I'm always thinking how big, much bigger the world is to birds compared to me. Like, I can only walk up the mountain, but they get to go up toward the sky and over the mountain and sideways and on the ground and just go from mountain peak to mountain peak. I can't do that. It must be such a different world for them. But second of all, bird flight is cool because birds are big and flying is hard. And in order to do this, birds have evolved some cool evolutionary solutions to these problems. And one of these solutions is hollow bones. Yes, birds have literally hollow bones. And that's because bones are super heavy. They're not like insects or mosquitoes that can fly easily because they're bugs and don't have bones. Birds have bones and they're heavy. And what they did is they basically hollowed them out in a way that would make it easier to fly. And flying is hard because it also depends on where you're lifting from, what environment you're flying around, and it all shapes bird wings and anatomy. For example, hawks in a forest have short wings and fast wing beats plus a long tail in order to make quick sharp turns and not to fly into trees, right? But open field hawks that don't live in a forest or eagles have these large wings and short tails, and they don't have to flap them as much because they're just soaring on the wind up in the sky without many obstacles in their way. When I was a kid, I always thought if I had a superpower, it would be the ability to fly. it would have been awesome. Another way to study birds is more inside the lab, and it's tied to bird brains. Birds are one of the few groups of animals, and this is only some birds, not all, that can learn vocalizations. And you'd be surprised that most animals on the planet cannot do this. They cannot learn how to vocalize new sounds. So, like, dogs can understand what you're saying, they can learn that, but they can't speak it back to us. And even our closest primate cousins, the apes and the monkeys, cannot learn to make new sounds, which is interesting because we're so closely related to them. You've probably seen videos of parrots. They're known for the ability to mimic lots of sounds and human speech. And maybe some of you actually have a parrot pet in your house. Because lots of people have parrot pets. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about learning vocalizations. The other animal groups that can learn new sounds are the bats and the cetaceans, which I mean by that are dolphins and whales. And that's it. Besides humans, of course, like we can learn, you know, whatever language you learn when you're a kid. That's what we do. And we humans think we're so special because we have language and we can write poetry and learn new languages. But animals, like some birds, can do some form of this new language learning on of their own. I'm not sure if they write poetry, but maybe they have a version of poetry. I don't know. I've actually always wondered that sort of thing. So this topic of learning new sounds is so interesting for people to study because it's so unique. It's something that we thought made us special in the past. And because birds are so different from us in terms of how their brain is shaped, they have bird brains. But what I mean by that is that their brains are structured differently from ours. And scientists are trying to figure out how their bird brains can be so intelligent and flexible and creative too. Birds are smart, period. So the way to study bird brains and bird language is made easier by bringing birds into the lab as opposed to studying them in the wild. This way we can scan their brain and experiment with birds in a very controlled setting, like teaching them certain calls and testing them on what they're able to retain and what they're able to create. It's much harder to do this in their natural habitat because they're always flying away. So now this is a good time to change topics and talk about what it's like for a scientist to study birds in the field or in the lab. And this is the fun part. Fieldwork is what I did for many years. Mostly for other researchers who hired me to do the dirty work, but it's the best dirty job I've ever had. Fieldwork is really the thing that made me fall in love with science, because it showed me the natural world, and it made me feel like I was part of the secrets of nature, you know, because I'm out there studying nature. But fieldwork involves long hours in the wild, usually deep in the forest or the wilderness, getting to know the specific ecosystem very well, day after day. It involves waking up before sunrise and hiking the terrain in search for birds, and is the most fun I've ever had. I did fall in love with science because this kind of job not only took me into nature, but it trained my mind in how to study the nature, the birds, and so on. It trained me to ask questions and make observations that can help us humans with our human brains try to understand a specific bird world, for example, or a bird community, or a bird species. Working in nature also constantly teaches me about life. I feel like I've learned so many life lessons by comparing life to the difficulties of off-trail hiking, getting lost in the wilderness, trying to find a tiny bird in a tree 70 feet above me, trying to remain as still as I can while listening for the presence of a bird, and of course, running after birds while simultaneously bushwhacking a dense forest. And often this would be in the summer in 100 degree weather where I've worked. So I'm doing all this while sweating through my clothes, but trying to protect myself from the sun with long layers. So yeah, it's super fun. And what did I record while doing all this stuff? Well, many projects actually focus on a specific bird species. So I have to learn the bird songs, calls, and behaviors in order to tune in with the individuals of that species in a specific setting. Although some research focuses on a bigger scope, like the diversity of all birds, and in that case, I have to record data from all the birds I hear and see in a specific location to assess the ecosystem as a greater whole, for example. But when you work with only one species, it's a bit more fun because you get to chase it all around the forest, map its territories with GPS, look for its nests, and even band the birds and their potential chicks during a breeding season. I haven't mentioned this, but a lot of field work usually takes place during the breeding season, which is around spring and summer in the northern continent. One of my favorite parts is looking for bird nests during this time. And I'm talking about songbirds here. And the work that I've done the most has been mostly been in forests with songbirds. So the job of a nest searcher or a nest finder is so delicate. Birds are experts at camouflage and hiding. Plus, songbirds are tiny. And by songbirds, I mean like the sparrows we have in Unalaska. And so their nests are tiny. And depending on the species, their nest can be found either under some rocks, on the ground, or in a small bush, or high up at the very top of a tree. And sometimes you have to climb the tree, by the way. It's not like with the bald eagles we have here in Unalaska, where their nests are one of the largest of all the birds. I think they can weigh up to 200 pounds, if I remember that correctly. And they're kind of obvious. You've probably seen some around town. But fun side fact, bald eagles nest on the ground in the Aleutian Islands only because there's no trees here, which is a unique adaptation to this environment, because usually eagles make nests way up in these large trees and nest at the very top of a tree. So their nests are huge and obvious from a distance. But with songbirds, you have to be like on your hands and knees, carefully prying apart the bushes to hopefully come across a nest without disturbing it. So that's how tiny they are. Usually it helps to find the female of the species because she stays close to a nest that she's built. And usually what she does is sit on the nest or come off the nest to forage for a little bit and then go back. This is different from the male, who's usually making the rounds, singing and establishing his territory, being super loud. Although sometimes males come to the nest to feed the female and even the chicks when they hatch. But this is all dependent on so many factors, though, like the species and even individual males. There's so much variety in their behavior. Whether one male helps and another male doesn't help his partner can be just due to their personalities, kind of like in humans, right? And the purpose of finding a nest is, by the way, to document the breeding success of a bird. This is another useful piece of data when researching a specific bird species. It is their breeding success, especially with recent climate changes, deforestation, and other alterations of habitat that humans have done. Some birds haven't been able to breed as well as they once used to. So documenting breeding success could also be part of a conservation research project. It could be looking at how thinning forest projects are affecting birds, how birds are doing in the new growth after a forest fire, or even how close a road is to their breeding ground. These can all affect breeding behavior and breeding outcome. If we want our birds to not go extinct and survive even with our development, we first need to find out what helps and what hurts these birds from reproducing. In the first episode, I mentioned a little bit about the banding process of birds. This is another useful tactic in science to keep track of individuals and also for long-term monitoring of these birds. And these are simply little band bracelets that we place on the bird's legs with a bunch of numbers and even some colors to identify them uniquely. This has been really useful in science because in the wild, you can't just identify small animals one from the other. So it's very helpful to study things like behaviors and social behaviors when you know who's doing what. And by the way, studying behavior in the wild is much better than taking those birds and putting them in a lab to see what they do and how they do things, because in the field, it lets the birds be their natural selves and the scientist is simply observing them in nature, like me if I was in the field, watching them through binoculars. However, it makes it a bit harder to know for sure why something is happening, because there is so much happening in the natural setting that we may not even be aware of. So lots of scientists take birds or other animals into the lab to study things like vocalizations and problem solving and making brain scans, as I've mentioned. It is much easier to see the results inside a lab for very complex things like whether a bird can problem solve, because you can give the bird a puzzle in the lab and ask it to solve it for a treat. But you can't necessarily do that in the wild, although people try it, and I think that's awesome. So I can go on and on about field work, though. I've worked in the field with different species on different research projects in different parts of the country for years. It's a hard job, and moving around for the jobs can be hard, living in cabins, sleeping in a tent for a long time, or backpacking and eating camp food for an extended time. There's also dangers to it, like getting lost, which is kind of common since it's the wilderness, but it's still dangerous. And also there's the danger of wild animals out there, and no matter what kind. And in my opinion, every animal is dangerous if they think you're a threat or you're in their territory and they're feeling scared, especially if they have babies. And I think just the feeling of fear or an animal scared is the only reason really that they would attack. And I actually had a brown bear encounter on Admiralty Island when I was doing field work in the Tongass National Forest. It's an island, so we had to get flown in for the week to do bird surveys and just camp on the beach there. It was me and another colleague. She knew about bears more than me, and she's really the one who picked up on the signs. But it all came to a head when the bear started throwing rocks down the hill at her tents and snapping his teeth from behind some trees. It was kind of far, so it was hard to see him. But the snapping his teeth and the throwing the rocks, it was a sign of aggression. It did take him like 24 hours, a whole day of following us around and throwing rocks for us to get the picture. And by that point, we were pretty terrified. Turns out we were in his feeding territory and he wasn't happy about that, where we were camping at least. I also found a huge pile of animal bones nearby where we camped when we first arrived, but at the time I had no idea this was a huge red flag, so that was my mistake. So we had to end the survey early and get flown out, unfortunately. But this is a happy ending. though, because we ended up safe and didn't have to use our rifle on the bear. But even though the wilderness can be scary, all it takes is knowledge and learning about animal behaviors and taking precautions. One of the requirements for many field jobs in Alaska is to carry a rifle into the backcountry because of chance encounters like what I just described. You just never know. However, our world is getting increasingly urban, which means large animals are getting pushed out. You know, we're building big cities, we have more people everywhere. And many research projects are turning toward looking at urban areas and studying the animals that live alongside humans these days. You know, like all the foxes in Alaska who roam the streets. Those, I feel like those would be called urban foxes. For another example, a bunch of studies came out after COVID hit that many birds in cities were changing their songs because everything shut down and there was less noise and less traffic. So birds were able to hear each other better. And so they were singing more the way they would if they were in a forest. And that's the thing about urban cities or wherever there's people living and working. There's lots of noise that's not natural. And it's changing how animals are existing in these environments. So in conclusion, science can be everywhere. It's on Admiralty Island with brown bears, and it's in urban cities with noise pollution. It is everywhere. And the study of ornithology is so broad and includes all kinds of projects, whether in the lab or in the field, whether working on conservation and ecology or on bird brains and bird hormones. And let's not forget that birds basically dominate the world, mostly due to flight and migration abilities. This makes birds truly a global topic of study that can include every kind of ecosystem found in the world. So go out there and pay attention to the birds. Are they singing? Are they breeding? Are they migrating? Are they learning human talk? Anything is possible. Okay, so this is where I start recommending you guys some books and resources to check out about the topic of birds. I definitely have several books that you should read. There's a lot of interesting nonfiction books about birds out there that are also entertaining because they teach you about birds, but they also make it relevant to culture and our lives, our human lives. One really good book that I like and I'm currently reading is called The Thing with Feathers by Noah Stryker. Another popular book is called The Genius of Birds by Jennifer Ackerman. And another book is a popular one is called The Beak of the Finch by Jonathan Weiner. And don't forget, there's also field guidebooks that help you identify bird species, and there's a whole lot of those out there. In terms of videos, there's this great movie called The Big Year. It's about birding. I love it because it's a movie about these three guys competing at the Big Year competition. The Big Year is a thing where people try to see as many birds as possible in 1 year in North America. Well, there's different categories of the Big Year. There's North America is the popular one, but there's also like the state, like you see as many birds in your state, or even the Big Year of the world, which is pretty expensive to do. But of course, most people just do it for fun. There's always a winner who spent a lot of money traveling all year and counting bird species. So, you know, the winner has a high number. And I think in North America, the current record or whatever, it's like 750 something species. That's about the number that people have. And the winner is like you know, he or she sees one or two more bird species than the others. So anyway, I love this movie because it shows us what it's really like to be a birder. It's such an innocent and challenging hobby. And it's also based on a book called The Big Year. Counting species is not my thing, but it's always cool to see bird species you haven't seen before, especially if they're pretty rare. I haven't seen any other movies about birding, and in my opinion, there should be more because lots of people do this for a hobby, and it's a really great social hobby as well. It trains your mind, your sight, your hearing, and gets you outside. And right now, that's basically the only places we can hang out because of the pandemic. So it's a good hobby. So let's go birding more. And until next time, keep your ears open to all the spring birds singing and your minds open to the science in your life.